Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
The housing news has been pretty sour lately.
So some mortgage news today could be a little refreshing.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good day to you. I'm Bob Moon in for Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update at Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, August 25th. It is a tiny morsel of good news and a banquet of bad housing news that's coming up.
A little later, the economics of keeping hope alive for Chilean miners half a mile underground. It's paper, not plastic, for Dylan concert tickets in San Fran, and one football player gets tackled by online social networking. All that ahead, but first.
Yesterday, news came down that the sales of previously owned homes plunged between June and July. So then here's this morning's big question. It's one we've asked before about people having problems with their home loans and whether they're getting any relief from programs designed to help. New report out today says yes. Efforts to prevent foreclosures are working out better these days. That's according to a group of state banking regulators who found homeowners who got recent mortgage modifications are less likely to wind up back in default. Marketplace's Amy Scott is with us live this morning from Baltimore with the latest. Good morning, Amy.
Morning, Steve.
Sounds like good news. Why the change?
Well, it's partly because home prices have stabilized. People who had their loan payments reduced last year were half as likely to fall behind as those who got a break in 2008. Here's how Chris Mayer at Columbia Business School explains it.
People who saw their mortgages modified watched house prices continue to fall, and that really killed many modifications that had started because people just saw that they're, even with the modification, they were terribly underwater.
As in, they owed the bank more than their house was worth. And, Steve, it wasn't just the market getting better. Mayer says lenders are also more willing to give people a reduction on the balance of their loans, not just their monthly payments, and that helps too.
Mm-hmm. So, Amy, how is this going to affect the housing market where, we have these lousy sales numbers?
Right. Well, in theory, it could mean fewer foreclosures than analysts have been predicting, and that could help stabilize the market. But this report points out that foreclosures still far outpace mortgage modifications.
Mm. Marketplace's Amy Scott reporting from Baltimore this morning. Amy, thanks.
You're welcome.
The latest data from consumer credit reporting agency TransUnion shows the amount of money people owe on credit cards in the second quarter dropped to the lowest level in 8 years. We're going to get a little analysis on that from William Dunkelberg. He's professor of economics at Temple University, joining us live this morning to talk about it. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So we're barely coming off a recession with high unemployment. How are people getting these card balances down?
A number of people, of course, are just paying on them. Another bunch, of course, are getting into trouble and are making deals with the card companies. That is, the card company knows they can't collect all the money, so it makes a deal and says, okay, if you pay half or if you pay whatever, we'll just write off the half and the rest of it you don't owe anymore, and so you are no longer in debt to us. And so a lot of those kinds of write-downs are occurring, and that's one of the reasons why the total amount of debt owed is falling. Is that the card lenders are just writing it off.
This negotiating, that's still alive and well?
Oh, yeah. You can see ads all over radio and TV to have someone negotiate for you, although you can probably do just as well on your own. You can just make an offer to the card company, and they can say yes or no. So if you owe $5,000, you say, look, I can't ever pay. You can't afford to take me to court. How about I pay $2,500, and you call us even, and You know, and often the companies will take that as an opportunity and do it.
If so much is going on along those lines, Professor, what does that tell you about the economy?
Well, we know the economy is weak. We see no job growth. We're going to revise the estimate of economic growth in the second quarter down to a measly 1.3% this Friday. That's my forecast. Not nearly enough to get unemployment rate down. 8 million people lost their jobs since the recession started back in January of 2008. Obviously, if you don't have a job, it's a lot harder to make those credit card payments, and that's the difficulty that we have. So on top of that, if you bought a house in the 2003-plus boom, you probably paid too much for it. You're underwater, so you're under pressure on your mortgage, and so it makes it all very difficult.
Professor of Economics William Dunkelberg from Temple University, thanks for your time today, sir.
Oh, thank you.
On the heels of yesterday's stunning 27% setback in sales of existing homes, this morning there's word demand for home refinancing is way up, lifting new mortgage applications to their highest level in more than 15 months. Let's try making some sense of it all with economist Richard DeKayser, who heads Woodley Park Research. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Once again, the Dow is threatening to slip below the 10,000 mark, as it did briefly yesterday. What do you think the latest housing numbers dealt us such a big blow? We've been struggling with that problem for many months now.
It all has to do with expectations, Bob. Most economists were expecting a terrible number, but it came in even far worse. So this raises concerns that maybe the housing market, which has stabilized unambiguously over the past year in terms of prices and sales, maybe is starting a second leg down. I'd say it's premature to draw that conclusion, but that's where the anxiety lies.
Yes, but what about today's numbers on new mortgage applications, mainly for refis? That's going to put extra cash into the hands of consumers just when the economy needs it, right?
Yes, it does. And this is what the economy needs. It needs a little time. And as people have been refinancing, for example, they're lowering their debt burdens. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, people were spending 19 cents out of every dollar to service their debts and other obligations. That's down to about 17 cents. May not sound like a lot, but that translates into billions of dollars, and that will provide some support.
So we're now in our third down week for stocks, Dow flirting with the 9,000s again. What does Wall Street need to turn this around, maybe if those new home sales numbers out in a few minutes aren't so bad?
That might help. We're going to get new home sales are important. They tend to close faster and be a little bit more leading indicator than the existing home sales number we saw yesterday, which was so very, very distressing. If we see a modest improvement here, that would suggest that really we've lived through the post-tax credit-induced downturn and that maybe we're seeing the nose turn up once again.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed. Economist Richard DeKayser at Woodley Park Research, thanks for your insights this morning.
My pleasure.
The Securities and Exchange Commission is likely to adopt a new rule today to make it easier for some stockholders to replace directors on corporate boards. Supporters say it'll improve the way companies are run, but Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports not everyone sees it that way.
Shareholders elect boards of directors, but the names on the ballot are approved by the company. Adding an independent nominee is practically impossible. Now the SEC seems ready to give large institutional stockholders the right to list their nominees on the same ballot.
This is all about accountability.
Stephen Davis with the Yale School of Management says the financial crisis revealed that many boards rubber-stamped corporate managers who took on too much risk and paid themselves too much.
If you've got a company that's really in trouble, you want to be able to give the owners of the company the right to name other people that might take the company in a different direction.
Businesses, though, think the SEC rule would mean too much government interference. The Chamber of Commerce's David Hirschman says regulators are picking winners and losers.
The question here is whether those minority interested shareholders should have a special leverage over the board, special access that average shareholders don't get.
The SEC's right to impose such a rule had been in question, but Congress gave it the authority in its recent regulatory overhaul. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You're
listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, August 25th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. S&P has downgraded Ireland's credit rating down to AA-, and the ratings giant said a worse grade could be on its way. The moves throw into question Ireland's fledgling economic recovery, and it once again exposes a catch-22 faced by several European countries. The BBC's Rebecca Singer reports.
Standard & Poor's is worried about how much it's costing Ireland to help out its troubled banks. The agency's new calculations put the Irish bill at over $100 billion. Richard Jeffrey from Cazenove Capital Asset Management says international financial markets aren't actually that worried about Ireland. They're wondering whether the same thing will happen to other countries.
There are still very extreme issues with public sector finances in countries like Greece, Portugal, to a lesser extent Spain. But then, of course, the contagion effect. Do we look at Italy? Do we look at France? And, of course, we've got to consider the UK as well.
Across Europe, governments are struggling with the problem of how to cut their spending without diverting too much money from a recovery. Ireland's downgrade reinforces the fact that finding the balance is a big challenge. But the real test will come on Thursday, when Ireland tries to raise up to $750 million in debt. The price the country gets will give a clear signal of what the market really thinks about its prospects. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
Thirty-three miners trapped a half mile underground for nearly 3 weeks have not been told how much longer they'll likely be stuck. But government reports say the ordeal could last several months, challenging the health and safety of the miners. Gideon Long is the BBC's reporter in Chile, and he visited the mine yesterday. This morning he joins us live to talk about how the mine collapse exposes the danger of the job. Good morning.
Good morning there, Bob.
Gideon, we know mining is a dangerous job, but are things any different in Chile, which is so dependent on mining for its economy?
Well, the short answer is no. Mining is obviously an intrinsically dangerous industry anywhere in the world. I would say, though, that Chile has a fairly good safety record in this area. It's a country which is steeped in mining tradition. It's absolutely essential to the economy. Mining accounts for over a half of Chile's export revenues, and this one country produces a third of all the copper in the world. And that means that they've got a long history of mining. Generally, safety standards around Chile's mines are very good, but it's a mixed picture. At the big mines, the safety standards tend to be good, but there are lots, hundreds of smaller mines dotted around the country where maybe things aren't quite so good.
You visited the mine. Set the scene for us.
That's right. I was up at the mine yesterday. It's bustling with activity. We're allowed to get as far as the entrance. We can see in where they're starting this drilling operation to try and rescue the miners. And just down below, there's a camp which has been set up where the relatives of the miners are basing themselves. They're living in tents. They've been there for over 2 weeks now. And they set up little shrines in the rocks, shrines to the miners down below with personal mementos, messages of goodwill from passers-by, and photographs of the miners as well. So it has a sense of permanence. The local authorities here have set up food, so they have something to eat. It feels like they will be there for some time.
And how are they planning on keeping them safe, healthy, and alive for months down the road here?
Well, now they've established this borehole 700 meters through the rock, which allows them to drop food and water down to the miners, so they can now keep them alive. They've also dropped medical supplies down there, and they've had some communication. They've managed to drop a phone line down there and a camera so they can see what's happening down there and they can speak to them. I think going forward from here, the key thing is going to be how they look after their psychological health, how they keep them sane, how they keep their spirits up. Interestingly, the Chilean government has been talking to NASA about this to get some information about how they train their astronauts. It's a slightly different situation because obviously astronauts know they're going up into space. They can prepare psychologically. These guys went into the mine thinking they'd be back home for dinner. So it's different in that sense. But otherwise, it's quite similar. You know, these guys are going to be in isolation for months. So the Chilean government is talking to NASA to try and learn from NASA's experience with astronauts.
The BBC's Gideon Long in Copiapó, Chile. Thanks.
Thank you.
They're known as non-governmental organizations, or NGOs for short. The term describes any organization dedicated to various social pursuits, from the World Disarmament Conference to the AARP. A recent survey by the government in India found more than 3 million non-governmental organizations are registered in that country. That's one NGO for every 400 citizens there. While the government appreciates the help, it says that might be too many. Raymond Thibodeau reports from New Delhi.
NGOs make up a growing $8 billion a year industry here. What makes India such fertile ground for these nonprofit agencies?
India has a beautiful story of economic growth on the one side, and on the other hand, there is still a huge story of poverty.
That's Thomas Shandy, spokesman for Save the Children.
About 45% of the children are malnourished. We lose about 2 million children every year under the age of 5. That is a terrible tragedy that is playing out on a daily basis.
Of course, not all NGOs care for the poor. Many focus on environmental or human rights issues or serve as government watchdogs. Still, India is drawing up new rules to keep closer tabs on NGOs. It's targeting groups that are ineffective or lack transparency, including so-called briefcase NGOs that exist mostly on paper and mostly to swindle donors. Shandy says the proposed laws have many NGOs worried.
The laws that are in the pipeline at the moment, if they are going to be passed, they are not going to be particularly good for NGOs in India.
Shandy says one of them is a tax on unspent donations. Supporters say the tax will stop otherwise tax-exempt NGOs from hoarding money meant for aid and development. Mandakini Devasher, a researcher for the Accountability Initiative, welcomes the added scrutiny. But she says the government needs to do a better job enforcing the rules that are already in the books.
If under law NGOs are submitting all this information to the government needs to do its homework. It needs to do its due diligence and to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Devasher says the federal agencies that monitor NGOs are too small to effectively carry out their watchdog role. So guess who's stepping in to help monitor the NGOs? You got it. More NGOs.
It's only natural that NGOs would also pick up on that. There's been a push for greater openness in government. So in a way, it's the kind of trickle-down effect.
For starters, many Indian NGOs have begun to voluntarily publish their annual reports online. Some analysts see it as a bid to stave off more regulation, in effect beating the government to the punch. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Bob Dylan plays San Francisco tonight at the city's Warfield Theater. If you missed the online rush to buy tickets, it's because there wasn't one. Tickets are only available at the theater box office. You can only pay with cash. Is it a new model for selling concert tickets? Here's reporter April Demboski.
Tickets go on sale tonight starting at 5:30. But theater staff are prepared for thousands of diehard Dylan fans to set up their lawn chairs before noon. House manager Larry Sykes hired security and armed his bar staff with water and Red Bull.
It's like I've rented porta potties for Market Street. We're going to have street performers for the line. I have a food cart coming.
It's a ticketing sales model from the old days, and definitely a publicity stunt on one level. But analyst Matthew Harrigan says there are practical and altruistic motivations, too.
It's obviously to keep people from scalping tickets. I mean, he's trying to be a good guy. Bob Dylan's just trying to make sure that it's not a matter of pricing some people in and pricing some people out.
But Ticketmaster, have no fear. While fans will be spared hefty convenience charges this time around, analysts say the all-day campout is an inconvenience that won't catch on. In San Francisco, I'm April Demboski for Marketplace.
For a lot of people, few things bring as much pleasure in the morning as that first cup of coffee. And for a number of companies, coffee is certainly big business. But the beverage has created some complicated recycling and environmental questions as well. Marketplace's sustainability reporter Adrian Hill joins me now in the studio with the latest. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning.
So what's the problem with coffee then?
Some of the ways we make coffee and the ways we drink coffee are posing some problems for companies that want to be environmentally friendly.
So break that down then.
Well, I bet a whole lot of people listening right now have in your hands or in your car cup holder a paper coffee cup. And it turns out those coffee cups are super hard to recycle.
But I thought paper you could recycle.
With paper in these paper cups, there's this waxy coating that actually proves really problematic. Basically, that waxy coating keeps your cup from turning into like a big pile of soggy coffee mush every morning. But it makes it tougher for recyclers, and there's just not that much interest in this paper. Starbucks is planning and wants very much by 2015 to make sure that all the paper cups it generates and it sells are recycled at its stores. But so far, recycling is only available available about 400 of its 7,500 shops. So they've got a long way to go.
And how many cups are we talking about, Adrian?
I've seen estimates as high as 58 billion with a B paper coffee cups are thrown out in the U.S. every year.
Wow. Now, that's a lot of cups.
And we haven't even mentioned styrofoam.
What about the folks who make coffee at home? You said there were issues with that as well?
Yeah, K-cups, those little single-use packets of ground coffee, they sort of look like creamer containers, are impossible to recycle. People like them, though. They're convenient. They're easy. And it's a real problem for companies like Green Mountain Coffee. It sort of built its business around environmental responsibility. But in the third quarter of this year, more than 80% of their net sales were related to those little non-recyclable K-cups.
Oh, wow. So what to do?
Well, if you're a company like Starbucks or Green Mountain Coffee, you're trying to innovate and get your suppliers to innovate quickly. The rest of us, regular coffee drinkers, maybe should consider brewing our coffee the old-fashioned way or bringing along a cup if you go out.
Marketplace's Adrian Hill here in the studio. Adrian, thanks.
Thank you.
I'm feeling guilty about getting that morning coffee? Well, there are five tips to make your cup more environmentally friendly at our website, marketplace.org.
And finally, a cautionary tale about using online social networks on the job. The NFL slapped Cincinnati Bengals wide receiver Chad Ochocinco with a $25,000 fine for tweeting.
Seems number 85 sent out messages just before and during last Friday night's preseason game against the Philadelphia Eagles. No, the Football League has nothing against Twitter, only the timing of Ochocinco's tweets. Hey, Bob, guess how Ochocinco apologized?
Don't tell me. He tweeted.
He did. He wrote, "I won't do it again." In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bob Moon. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.